All right. So anybody, so we last thing we discussed was the Republican scene, the Clover issue about the correlativity of rights and duties. Both Republican scene and Clover tried to say that halacha is more focused on duties at the expense of what? The expense of rights. And I was trying to push back and show that certainly in the halachas that we briefly looked at last week, so let me see if the projector here will work. So, for example, in many cases, the Rambam talks about dinim, din shomrim, din nachala, din sachir, din chovel b'chavero. Well, it's turning on now. Which is supposed to be neutral between the rights part and the duties part. So I think din is just like a nice neutral formulation. Then we saw other cases where the halacha clearly and directly emphasizes the rights-based part. Right? We saw, for example, the Rambam Niske Mamon Hey Aleph, that the shepherd, the property owner, has the rights. Yesh reshus lebal hasada lishchot the trespassing animals if he fears that they're going to cause harm. Correct? We also saw an example, Yesh la'adam lasos din la'atzmo, which is another clear case where a person has the right to self-help or to do justice on his own. And another example is, Rambam said, Sheyochal hasachir min ha'mechub bar sha'asa, that a laborer has the right to eat from the produce that he's working on. So those are clear cases where the halacha is either neutral and din, or the halacha is emphasizing the rights-based piece. But we should look, try to keep a list of like all the cases, and then at the end of the day, figure out if there's a clear preference to formulate things in terms of duties or rights. Good. Does that sound... You guys remember that from Tuesday? Okay. So today I want to take a closer look at the correlativity of rights and duties. And this is important for the Weinreb framework, where Weinreb wanted to say that the bipolarity of the plaintiff and defendant means that my rights are correlative to your duties and your duties are correlative to my rights. That's the coherence of the private law relationship. So the Hofeldian framework is going to flesh out the nature of the bipolar private law relationship between a plaintiff and a defendant. So if you look at Canvas, Cole, do you have access to Canvas, by the way? Cole, are you there? I'm here. Hopefully he does. So let's take a look at...
Sorry, yeah, I was on mute. Sorry, I was on mute. I was on mute. Yes, I have access.
Okay, I have access to it now. So you can see all the articles that I uploaded.
Yeah, I have the second Hofeld article.
Okay, the second Hofeld article. Just talk louder when you do talk up.
Yeah, I
can. Well?
All right, if I can do that.
Yeah, try to talk loudly and clearly if you can. If not, we'll just have to go back to the phone system. Yeah, can you talk for a second? Let's see if we can hear you.
Hi.
Yeah, Kier's a little. Yeah, Kier's a little clearer, right? Okay, maybe better interface.
Scott. I can hear you here.
Okay, good. So let's take a look at the Hofeld framework and try to get his system down. I think it's a very powerful framework, and it's going to allow us to be more precise and tease out a more nuanced analysis of the dinim that we're going to see throughout this month. So, who read the Hofeld piece? Yeah, Yoni? You're the...
I read the Hofeld.
I read the Stanford.
Yeah, you read the cheat sheet.
Right.
So let's take a close look at the Hofeld framework for a second. Who? Alright. So let's take a close look at the Hofeld stuff. The first thing I want to point out about Hofeld is in the first half of the article, he makes an important distinction. I think it's somewhat obvious, so we don't have to focus on it. He makes an important distinction between what he calls here on page... Yakulumen. So on page 20 of the first article, that's the fundamental legal conceptions. So he makes an obvious distinction between legal conceptions contrasted with non-legal conceptions. I don't think we have to go into that. His point is that there are often things that you can do that aren't actual legal relationships. And in analyzing these halachos, primarily we're interested in the legal conceptions, not the physical conception, the non-legal conceptions. So of course, for example, Poel can back out of his contract, right? He cannot show up. That's different from the legal right to not show up, or the legal liberty to not show up. So this is a very elementary point, but as Hofeld shows, people confuse these two different points here and there. So I don't want to go into this now unless one of you has an important comment to raise with respect to it. Any of you have a Yoni?
Well, I just feel like in halakha, there might be more of a blur between, like, because halakha controls so much of, like, the daily life, there might be less of a distinction between, like, legal, maybe things that maybe Basin can't actually do anything about, but there's still, like, a legal or some type of normative ruling
for
certain activities.
Well,
if Paul's not showing up to the contract, maybe Basin can't penalize him for it, but at the same time, like, clearly it's a moral wrong. At the same level, like,
So I think the moral wrong we'll still consider to be a legal wrong halachically, because anything that has this kind of normative force we're going to view as legal for our intents and purposes.
We're differentiating between things that, you know, they're morally correct. Wrong, but basically have
I would just think there are some laws that are, there are some rules that are enforceable, some that are not enforceable, but I see all those as being legal in this sense. So that's just important. That's how we're going to lay the groundwork. Correct. Misha Parah is still a legal category. It may not be enforceable in the same way as a stronger claim right is.
Okay, there's a broader scope there.
Yes. Correct. Here's just a good example where Hofeld shows how people confuse the legal versus the non-legal conception. So on page 22, he quotes some authors who say, is actually from a decision, the term property is commonly used denotes any external object over which the right of property is exercised. So what's Hofeld pointing out here?
Property is a relationship.
That's right. So the authors of this quote confuse the legal idea of property. So the legal idea is the legal relationship that you have with the object, or the legal relationship literally you have with others vis-a-vis the object. But the authors confuse that with literally the physical object itself, right? So it doesn't denote any external object over which the right of property is exercised. The concept of property refers to the legal relationships that relate to the object. It doesn't refer to the object itself. That's just like an interesting observation. But we don't need to get into this part of the analysis. What's crucial for us is his framework of what he calls jural relations. So Hofeld has four fundamental relations. Each has a correlate. So what are his four fundamental relations, Yoni?
There's privilege, there's claims, power.
Yeah. So what he calls rights, which we'll just refer to as claim rights, privileges, which we could either refer to as a privilege or a liberty, powers, and immunities. So let's start with rights and duties. So this is on page 30 of the Hofeld article. And Hofeld's first observation is that people tend to conflate the use of rights, or they use the word rights in such a general way that it ceases to have a precise meaning. So the word rights sometimes just means like a legal advantage. And Hofeld's arguing that there's a way to be more precise about the term such that you could gain better traction over the actual legal relationship. So give me the essence of claim right, Yoni.
A right is a shield.
What is it? Cole?
I said a right is a shield.
You're saying generally a right is a shield.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying? So I think Cofield has actually a different... Yeah, Cole, we can't hear you. Why, you guys have difficulty hearing him? Difficulty hearing him? Yeah. Yeah. Cole, you have to talk really loudly, or... Yeah. So Cole said that it's like a legal shield. Maybe that's the best way to think of right. I don't think that's the best... I think Hofeld's intentionally trying to avoid that kind of usage. So here on page 31 of the article, Hofeld says that... He says, we're looking for a clue to figure out its true meaning. And immediately he tells us, and this is his first key insight, the clue to understanding what a claim right is lies in the correlative duty. For even if you use the term right in its broadest sense, we're accustomed to thinking of duty as an invariable correlative. So this is Hofeld's most important insight. And he quotes, what does footnote 32 push us towards? Yeah, so it's another decision. A duty or a legal obligation is that which one ought or ought not do. Duty and right are correlative terms. When a right is invaded, a duty is violated. So here he's making the case that just the analytic conception of a right is that it's correlated to a duty. And here's the clearest formulation. If X has a right against Y... that he should stay off the former's land. So if I have a right that Yoni stay off my land, the correlative is that Yoni is under a duty towards me to stay off the place. And I think that's right. I mean, I think that's exactly the right conception of what these are. To have a right is to be a right bearer is to hold it against somebody else who has a duty to you. Now, of course, Wittgenstein and Cover are moving in a different direction. They're trying to argue that there are these duties that exist independent of any correlative right. And at least in Hofeld's framework, that's impossible. Okay. Nakir, any comments on that? Okay. No comments from Nakir. You any comments? Ben? So the next thing in Hofeld's framework are privileges, or what people sometimes call liberties. So what's a liberty?
Is that a question?
Yeah. Or what's a privilege? We're using them interchangeably.
Is a non-duty.
Yeah, so a privilege is a no duty. Right, it means that I have no obligation. So if I have a privilege, but a no obligation to the contrary, right? So if I have a liberty or a privilege to use the sidewalk, that means I'm under no duty to forbear from using the sidewalk, right? Correct?
Yeah.
And what's the correlate? Right. So what does it correspond to in the opposing party? What does a liberty, what does a privilege correspond to?
No right.
Right, so if I have a privilege against Yoni to use the sidewalk, that means that Yoni has no right, no claim against me that I forbear from using the sidewalk. It's very important to get these concepts down. What? So it's the correlate of a no claim, a no right. Right? So if I have a liberty, that means that I have no duty to forbear. And it means that you have no right that I forbear. Right? I think that's a very precise way of understanding what a liberty is. Cole, is that consistent with your understanding?
Yes.
Yes, right. I think it's like a very clear way of trying to make sense of what analytically what a privilege or a liberty cashes out in terms of. Let's see, it's Hofeld. Hofeld gives us an example. So he says, a privilege is the opposite of a duty and the correlative of a no right. So this is on page 32. So in the last example, so whereas I have a right that Yoni stay off my land, so I also have a privilege of using my own land, meaning I'm under no duty to not use it, right? Or in equivalent words, I have no duty to stay off. Is this clear to you? Any questions on that privilege? So who could think of a good example in halacha? Give me an example of a clear claim right. Somebody give me an example of a clear privilege. If you could think of one off the top of your head. Take a second to think about it. Yeah, so Nazikin is clearly a claim right. Right, so I have a claim against you. I have a right against you that you not harm me. And correlativity, you have a duty not to harm me. Right? I think that's a very clear example. So what do you mean by Hilfa Shchenim?
I have privilege of having oven in my chatzar.
Yes, that's the chatzar cases.
Oh, good. Meaning, so like the Adam Oseh B'toch Shelo.
Yeah.
Like those cases in Bava Basra.
Like I can make a cake in my chatzar.
Yeah, very good. That's exactly like Hofeld's example, right? Let's call it, we don't want to use terms that are going to be ambiguous, but I have a, so we're not going to say zchus, but all right, but I have a privilege or a liberty to use my chatzar for my own productive interests, right? I could have, like you said, I could light a fire within my own chatzar generally. I could have a tanur, I could dig a bore, right? I'm under no duty to forbear from doing so within my rishus. Here I have a list of examples that I thought may be good examples, but I still want more time to think about them. So, a poel's right to eat from his employer. What is that? What do you think that is? Yakir, what do you think that is? A poel's right to eat from his employer's mechubar lekarka, let's say, before gemar melacha.
Sounds like a privilege.
Yeah, so it sounds like a privilege, right? He's under no duty to forbear from eating. Right, so that sounds like a privilege. And it doesn't seem to be a claim right, because it doesn't seem to be the case that the owner has a duty to provide him with food. Right? Yakir, does that sound right? Yakir?
Sorry, repeat that last point?
Meaning that we... If it were a claim right, then the field owner would have a duty to provide food to the poel, which doesn't seem to be that case in halacha, right? So it's merely a privilege or a liberty. It doesn't seem to rise to the level of an actual claim right. Had it been a claim right, that would mean that the balabayas has a chiyuv to supply him with food. Ben, does that make sense? Are you confused about that? Well? Okay.
Wait, if he did have a duty?
Yeah. Then it would be a claim, right?
Doesn't have to.
No. Because... Correct. Because... what's key in distinguishing the liberty from the claim right is whether the correlate.
Meaning it, whether I can choose.
Right, correct. Meaning you could it's perfectly, you don't have to exercise your right. It's perfectly consistent to have a right that you're forbearing from exercising. See that? That's why it's good to get the Hofeldian framework down, because that's exactly his point. To distinguish them is look at the correlate. or look at the also look at the opposite, right? Okay, good. So I think a poel maybe eating from the Baal Bayis is just a good example of liberty, right? And your example in Baal Bayis was also excellent. Cole, any comments on this?
No.
Okay. Good. So from here, we move to what's next in his list?
Power.
Yeah, power. So what's a Hofeldian power? Let's see, what page do power start on? Yoni, tell us about a Hofeldian power. Yeah, go for it, Cole.
I think a power is the ability to impose a cost on someone else.
So not quite power to impose a cost. Wait, say it again. Oh, the ability to impose a cost. So I could impose a cost on you just by crashing into you on the road. Right, so Hofeld will say that. That's right. That's exactly right. So it's your second formulation, not your first.
Yeah.
Right. So.
Yeah.
Right. So Yoni, what's so flesh it out for us, Yoni?
I guess by power,
like the ability to.
I meant not.
Yeah, the ability to change or legal relationship to someone else.
That's exactly right.
Change their rights, their rights and their privileges.
Exactly. So a power is a legal ability to change somebody else's rights and privileges. Right. That's why if you saw in the Stanford Encyclopedia article, they quote Hart as saying that powers are like second order in the sense that they are your ability to change someone's first order rights and liberties. Right. Now, Hofeld's pointing out that people just use the term right to refer to all these different relations, and they're clearly distinct. Right. There's a difference between Ben owing me a duty and my having the ability to change his normative rights. So Hofeld's saying that latter thing is a power. So give me a few examples of where we're going to see powers in halacha.
Basically.
Sure. The courts, the bezin has a certain power to affect the rights that somebody has, right? So you might say, a hefker bezdin hefker is a classic example of a legal power, right? So you're changing the kinds of rights that people have in their property. So give me another example.
Sure.
And maybe that's there it's not clear that you're changing somebody else's.
Or you're changing your relationship with that.
Okay, so give me a clearer Choshen Mishpat example. Good, right, the ability to contract or something is that you hold a certain power over somebody to impose rights on them, to impose certain duties on them, right, or to change the duties that they have. In the Stanford article, what's the example that they give of power? So, what is it? Ben, you're the Stanford man.
Yeah.
So what's their example of a Hofeldian power? Yeah, of course. It's right here.
Right, yeah. Monsters are some interesting examples.
Yeah. So you might even say, look, it's the power of a... So it's like they hear a ship captain's ability to order a midshipman to scrub the deck.
Just maybe a boss telling the worker to do something.
So that's a non-legal relationship, right? No, a boss just telling a worker. So it's got to be that the nature of the relationship is such that the command creates new duties in the employee.
That order was stipulated, sort of?
Right. Or that he had the right to...
I went with the boss. Maybe
Bob?
Why isn't that the same thing? A boss tells an employee to... Because you're saying that's just a privilege?
Well, no. I mean, so it depends. Assuming that the relationship is such that the employee's got to do what the boss tells him, so then a new command is a power, right? He has the power to change the obligations and duties that the employee has.
Yeah.
Correct.
You're saying that's...
Right. I mean, it has to create new duties.
Yeah, create new duties. Correct.
Exactly. Right. So you have to have you have the legal power to change the duties that that person has. So here's an interesting question. So does a ganav have a power to change a nignav's rights? Does a ganav hold a power?
If he's doing kona, then yeah.
Yeah, 100%. That's exactly right, Cole. Right, so a ganav has a Hofeldian power to... He surely doesn't have a right to steal, right? He doesn't have a right to go ahead and take your stuff, but he has a power to change the rights that you have in your possessions. See that? Because when he steals and he gains good title... That means you no longer have the rights to transfer, the rights to the payros of the thing that he stole, etc., etc. So that's like just an easy example of Hofeldian power. Here's another question. So is the Poel's ability to be chozer, v'emtza hamalacha, is that a kind of a Hofeldian power? A poel's ability to be chozer v'emtza hamalacha. What do you think that is?
If he has the privilege, the right to be chozer, but not.
So, well, let's just think. What's a right? We don't want to just... So a right is ambiguous. That's Hofeld's point, right?
If he has the ability, if it's written into the law...
Yes, so the Torah says that Kili b'nei Yisrael avadim or Kol b'chozer b'emtza hamalacha.
It's not changing anything.
Well, isn't he changing the rights that the Baal HaBayis has in his labor?
But doesn't the Baal HaBayis then have like a corresponding claim against him? In terms of like the boss?
I guess, but so it may, the power may... I mean, it's true in the Ganav case also, right? So a Ganav has the power to gain... He has a power over a Nignav. He can change the Bailus over the Chefetz. But the power will give rise to certain liabilities as well. Right? Same thing in the Poel case, right? So a Poel, I think, has the power to be Chozer. He changes the kinds of rights that the Baal HaBayis has in his Melacha. It may, in parallel, give rise to certain duties or certain liabilities as well. But I don't think that's inconsistent with it being a power.
But then we know it can be both a power and a claim right.
So why would it be a... So remember, a claim right... So you wouldn't have a... I mean, is the Baal HaBayis under a duty to let him go? Is that what you're saying? Or is the idea that the Baal HaBayis has no ability to stop it?
Or maybe the privilege of thinking people with a privilege and a power.
Yeah. Right. I think that's true. Yes, you could definitely have something that's both a privilege and a power. Right? I mean, so you might say I think it's controversial whether he's under no duty to remain, to do the malacha. He has... Let's put it this way. He has the power to be chozer, right? But he may not have a liberty to be chozer. Because he, even though the Torah says he could back out without penalty, right? There may be some sort of taromes or some sort of like moral violation for his doing so, right? Yeah, so you have to, it's like these categories could get confusing. But once you have them down, they actually illuminate rather than confuse. Okay. Any other examples of a power somebody wants to give? Ben, you have any other examples of power?
I just want to make a... Itamar?
Yeah. Go for it, Cole. I'm listening.
I wonder if this is true. This is maybe more of a conjecture, but I imagine that, it makes sense. Right, duty, and privilege are more on the Isser Beheser side of Dine Mamanos, whereas power, liability, and immunity and disability are pretty much all, because they have to do with changing legal relationships, are all on the, they're granted, but they're,
Let's hold off on this comment because I think it's gonna sidetrack us a little bit.
Okay.
So hold the thought for a minute and let's get back to it later. But I'm not sure if I agree just from the initial comment.
I don't know if I agree either.
Okay. So of course the power to create a shliach. So kind of a shliach has certain powers to be kone on behalf of the mishaleach. That's clearly a Hofeldian power. I think Hofeld gives that example as well. A malve has a power to take a mashkon, right? Meaning he could change the normative rights that the lova has in his nechasim through his power to seize assets and collection of the debt.
And he's also doesn't have
a
privilege, so he can't take a mashkon. Well, he doesn't have a privilege, so he might not.
Right, because he might need a bezdin to. Yeah, well, it's an interesting question then. If you think the bezdin issue is a problem, does he have a power or does? So, we'll get to this actually. There's going to be an important question as against whom the power and privilege and claim is held. That's where Hofeld's framework further illuminates. Right, so is the power held against the Bezdin, or is the power held against the third party? That's going to be an important point that we'll get to. So what's the that's what a power is. What's the correlative? What's the correlate of a Hofeldian power?
Liability.
Yeah, liability. That's exactly right. Right, so if I'm a love and the malva has a power to take a mashkon, then that means I'm liable for him to take it, right? My assets are liable to execution. Right? I think that's a very intuitive sense of understanding what liability is, right? So if a poel has a power to be chozer, that means that the Baal Bayis has a certain liability which makes him vulnerable to the Poel's power. You see that? Yeah? Notice how the word chayiv is equally ambiguous. Right? So how do you translate the word chayiv? Yeah, so chayiv could just be a duty. So what's the case where chayiv just means a duty? It's a chayiv of shalim, right?
Right.
A guy of his chayiv to pay compensation, that's clearly just a duty. Does chayiv ever mean a liability? What do we mean by liability? A liability is just the correlate of a power.
Right,
like
susceptible.
Well, yeah, like a vulnerability, right?
Right.
What do you think, Yoni?
I'm trying to get examples.
My examples on the sheet are not perfect.
Okay. Like, I think of like 5 minutes.
What?
In the cloud is a liability, it may not happen. Meaning those things may not be imposed upon you, but there's
right.
a possibility that they're imposed upon you.
Right.
So I feel like I usually means that something is being imposed upon you.
So let's think. Do we have any...
Right.
It just sounds like it's a straightforward duty, right?
Yeah.
Right, he has the power. Right, you're liable. That's good. So your chayav bidei shamayim is really a kind of liability that it may turn into a chiyuv, right? Or take. Here's the best case. So you could be chayav. So you take your chayav bidei shamayim thing. So that means that toveya has the power through tfisa. Right, he has a power of tfisa to take your stuff. So in that sense, you're liable, right? You're susceptible to his power of tfisa, even though you're under no duty to pay him.
What's the
lashon of chayav, you said? Well, chayav bidei shamayim.
That's more of like a consequence of chayav bidei shamayim. Like, that's like more...
Even they're related, they did one step. Because of chayav bidei shamayim, that's why I thought like two separate things. Chayav bidei shamayim also...
Right. Well, I'm saying any case of tfisa, l'chora, would be a case where the toveya, let's say, or the nizak, has a power, and there's a clear correlative liability, right? So he's chayiv to him, even though it's not yotze b'dayanim. Here's a good case. He's chayiv ain't a yotze b'dayanim. The term you're saying.
Yeah, I think it's a good example of power.
Chayav. Well, if the term chayav b'dinei shamayim means right liability in this sense, then right. But you're saying the term just means a duty. You have a duty klape shmaya
yeah,
to pay.
I don't think chayav b'dinei shamayim means tfisa. It's just like that one of the ways, one of the corollaries of, or not the word corollary, one of the
right.
consequences.
Right, it is the liability. But it's not what the term is meant to stand for. Yeah, Kier, what do you think? Do you have thoughts on this? Here, the question is, does the term chayiv ever mean this, like, Kofeldian liability? Right?
Yeah.
So here's an example. Cool, are they doing construction over there? I mean... Kier, they're doing construction?
No, it's not me.
Yeah, sorry. That's me. I'll mute myself again.
Okay. They don't have to mute yourself, but... So here I think is a good case.
Why did Nick Deere not have to mute?
Fine, you're right. Fine, Kier, you can mute. So... what about someone who's Chayiv Malkus, right? Is somebody Chayiv Malkus, does that mean that they have a duty to get Malkus? Or does it mean that they have a liability for the Beis Din to impose Malkus on them? Well, that might be a good
idea. Liability, yes.
Right, so in that sense, it's a liability, right?
The thing about it is like,
right, Chayav Misa.
You're supposed to get, Chayav
Misa.
But you're supposed to. Also, Chayav Misa, like, we don't always impose that.
Right.
Practically. It's more like.
Right. Oh, here's a good example.
Well,
right, meaning you're liable such that the Beis Din could exercise its powers, right? But you're not under like a duty in that sense, right?
Right.
So maybe in that sense, chayiv means liable. Let me just think of another example. Well. It's an interesting question. Does Bezin have a duty to do so, or they have the power to do so? Right, so that would be like a liability. That's a clear liability, right?
Right, so that's interesting. is it doesn't have to do.
No, but that's only because they don't have to prove whatever it is, like the rabbis, they made for a certain
right.
condition which are very difficult to uphold. But if you actually put a whole of condition, that basically mandated it.
Right.
No, they have a choice.
How much? That's an interesting question. I'm not sure. Bezin Machin Bon Shlomon Adin, or right, you're saying it's interesting. We have to look at how that Chir Bezin is normally formulated, right? Are they Mechuyuv to Lodin, etc.? What about this case? What about the word Shibud? Sometimes you talk about like a Shibud, I'm a Shubud. So does that just mean, so my assets are Meshubud for the Chov? So there, I think that means I'm Chayiv to pay, right? I have a duty to pay off the debt. But my assets are mishubadim in that they're liable to be collected. So maybe shibud is more accurately characterized as a liability. It's something to look at.
I have the power.
Right. The
power to collect the shibud.
That's right. He has the koach to execute collection through the lien. Something like that. Yes. Yeah, so one of the things you'll see already from the Makoro sheet that I sent out, there's a lot of interchange. The Rishonim use these terms shibud and kinyan and chiyuv in like almost an interchangeable way. I think we should try to be as precise as possible. At least we should try to distinguish between them. Maybe we'll see some Rishonim who are actually precise in distinguishing between exactly the different kinds of chiyuvim and shibudim, etc.
The word kinyan is
promiscuously misused, right?
Yeah, I mean, it has become, it is misused over, it is a meaningless, we should be scotched.
Yeah.
We should get rid of the word, it means nothing.
Yeah, so I agree.
It means everything.
That's right, I agree. Right now, we're not going to deal with Kenyan yet, but at least we could, for the time being, we could deal with terms like Chiyuv and Shibud. Right?
Alright, fine.
But the question exactly is, yeah, what's the Kenyan? Maybe Kenyan will be able to shed some light on Kenyan as well.
Why is Kenyan abused?
Why is it abused?
Yeah.
It always means what?
Relationship between
yes.
two things.
Right. I think Cole, so here I think Cole's right. Yoni's saying that isn't Kenyan just acquisition?
Yeah.
But there are cases where it's...
No, of course not.
Right. It's definitely used more broadly than to mean acquisition.
Such as
When Rosenfly gave fear on confusion...
You have to scream. Cole, you have to scream so that Yoni could hear you.
Sorry. When Rosenfly gave fear on confusion, I guess it was 4 years ago, there were at least 3 shiurim on the subject of how a isha dignit begimel tvarim does not mean that a woman is acquired to 3 things. It means that the status of heiresses is affected through 3 means.
Right. Except that there probably means acquired. No, I don't know.
Acquired might be the most precise definition.
Right. Yeah, except, but for example, like a... But for example, like a Kenyan Chalipin as a Gemiris Das, right? That's not an acquisition.
Quite a form of acquisition.
Is it? So.
Absolutely. No point in that Chalipin is a type of acquisition. It's just a different way of doing it.
No, sometimes a Kenyan Chalipin is just meant to show that this is done seriously, right? So I appoint a Shliach with a Kenyan Chalipin.
It makes it more formal, that's the point. Yeah.
But it's not an acquisition. It's just a. Right? It's a.
I formalize my right first.
Okay, but then it's formalizing and it's not about acquiring.
Well, acquiring might be like a loose definition, be a little more better defined as
right. We'll see, because we're actually a lot of this is a good example. So when we get to conceptualizing Schiris Poland, you might think that there's an agreement here, right? And maybe that's what a Kenyan Schiras Poalim is a binding agreement between two parties. When we look at the Sugyas, you'll see the Rishonim start talking about it in terms of like an acquisition of rights like in the Poel, right? Which is not just like a binding agreement, it's a kind of acquisition of title over the servant. Right? That's going to be a clear case where the term kinyan is ambiguous, or at least abused in the...
I'm reminded at this point of the great C.S. Lewis line that, like, people, you know, use the word my, M-Y, refers to, like, my shoe, my friend, my father, my lord. Like, those are, you know, those things. It's the same thing.
Okay.
Like, you know, that,
he's saying that the term my can be similarly abused. That's the... like my father, my shoes, my lord, right? But, and yeah, you're saying in the possessive sense.
Right, exactly.
Right. Okay, so we got this.
They belong to me, but I belong to the Lord.
Right.
Yet they're both mine.
Right. So that's the Hofeldian power, and it's correlative of a Hofeldian liability. And I think we want to keep our eyes open for just clear cases where... in halacha, we're going to be precise about a liability versus a duty. But Yoni, you're clear on the terms, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I need more the implications
question. Well?
The applications are on the question.
Yes, but on the concepts. Yeah. Notice, by the way, in the Zapersky article that we read on the, for just generally about private law versus public law, Zapersky made the point that private law really confers powers of action on the individuals, right? So what private law does is that it gives me a power of action against a defendant, right? It gives me a right to change his normative situation through the court system, etc., etc. Yeah?
Well, why is that change? If at the court that we change, like, why is that just like a privilege? Okay, I have a privilege.
Well, the privilege would just mean that I'm under no duty.
Yes, yeah, so I have the privilege to take you to court. And then the court has the power to then change your relationship.
Yeah, okay, good. So this is the problem. Zapersky is not precise about that. But I have a power against the court system to bring a case.
Okay.
Right? So meaning the courts can't say, oh, we're not interested in your claim.
Right, okay.
They have a liability to hear my taina.
Right, because the person doesn't tell you, you don't have the power against.
Correct.
I mean, would be that.
Exactly. That would be a direct power that the Nizak has over the Mazik, right? It's a power over Bezdin, correct? And Bezdin has a liability to hear your taina, right? So you might say, you know, does Bezdin have the ability to refuse a Tovea's claim and say we're not interested in hearing it? Right, if it's a valid claim, they'd be liable to having to hear it, right? Oh, here's another example of a good liability. So I have, like, in a shvuas, well, we don't need more examples of powers and liabilities, but just an example of subpoenaing somebody to testify. Right, so I'm tovea you to give edus, so maybe I have like a power over you to obligate you to come testify, and you have a correlative liability to my tvia. That's a similar idea. Okay, so what's...
I guess they do it like the tovea has the power to bring someone else to court. You don't have the power in terms of, like, bring enforcement.
Yeah. Well, again, it's not clear if the Tovea has the power or the Bezdin has the power.
Well, they can choose which court. They can get the power to choose which courts.
Maybe.
That's like the Sanhedrin.
Right. Yeah, I want to go to Bezdin Shabir and things like that. Right, but it's not clear if the power there is the power vested in the Tovea, or is the power vested in the Bezdin to... Yeah, meaning, so it could be that there's a relationship that the Tovea has to the Bezdin, a power liability, and then the Bezdin has power liability with the Mazik, with the Nidba. Right, that would be the intermediary relationship, as opposed to the Avodah Nishdin and Afshei paradigm, where the relationship is directly between the Tovea and the Nidba. Okay. So the last of the Hofeldian incidents is What's our last one? Cole, do you remember? Or Yoni? Or
you?
So it's immunity? Good. So what's an immunity? The opposite of a... So how's it working? Immunity is the opposite...
Of a liability.
Of a liability.
Right, it's the opposite of a liability. And it's correlative of a no power. Right? So if I... So you might say that the First Amendment right to free speech, it's not really a right, right? There's no correlative duty. It's really an immunity, meaning the government has no power to abridge my freedom of speech, right? They have no power to enact a law that would take away my right to free speech.
Well, they do if they start the amendment.
Right, okay. But the amendment itself confers that immunity, right? So again, so an immunity is means that the opposite party has no power. And did I get that right? Yes, the opposite party has no power, and its dual opposite is that there's no liability, I think. Did I get that right? Let's see. Yoni, did I get that right?
Sounds right.
Sounds
right? Yeah, here. An immunity is the correlative of... Oh, sorry. An immunity is the correlative of a disability, right? Of no power. Correct. And it's the opposite of a liability. That's right. So, do we have any good examples in halacha of an immunity? Well? Oh, good. I mean, like a katan is immune from being brought to Bezdin or something like that. Like in Makablan Eidos, like Shlodif Nebachov or something like that. That's a good example. Anybody else have an example of an immunity? Oh, here's one that I thought.
The exemption of Talmid Chachamim from certain taxes.
Oh yeah, good. The Sugya and Bavas are about the Talmid Chachamim are immune from certain taxes, right? That's a good one.
Yeah, correct.
So that means that the community has no power to impose a duty to contribute to the communal tax. That's a good example, Paul. So you see, people will typically say that, oh, Talmud Chacham has a right to not participate in taxes.
Is
right?
Is that
an immunity or just there's no duty? So it's more than that. Not only does he have no duty, but the community can't obligate, they can't do something to try to obligate him. Well... That's right. That's why it's stronger, right? It's, so let's give another example. So let's say Talmud Chacham, following the Gemara in Shavuos, is immune from having to go testify in court if the court is lower than him, like Pachas Mimena B'Chachma. Right? So that means that a Toveya has no power to summon a Talmud Chacham to be made on his behalf. Something like that. Right? So it's not just like a that right now he has no duty. I have no duty, like anybody has no duty to testify until they're summoned. Right? But the point is that even when he's summoned, he is immune from somebody else having a power to compel him. Yeah, I thought there's an example also here in, so for example, about what about a regular person's immunity from being brought to secular court? Right, so in halacha, not only do I, so people would say that, you know, a Jew has a right to go to Bezdin rather than secular court. But it's more than a right, it's really an immunity, right? Meaning there's nothing that a Toveya can do which would obligate him to go to Arkos. Right? That's, here's another example maybe. What about the chiyuv of, I'm not sure about this actually. I need to think about this other example. So what are the chiv of a malve to give back a mashkon like lahafzir sakar ba laila vesa machresha ba yom? What do you think that is? Well? Yeah, is that a kind of an immunity or is that just right, so the malve has a power to take a mashkon in general, but not with respect to like a machrisha bayom and a kar balayla. Like he can't, like he's powerless to take those kinds of things. And I think that'd be like a.
Well,
who has a duty?
The
malve. I mean, he just has a duty to give it back.
Why not just a regular duty?
Does he have a duty to give it back, or does he have a disability from holding it? So it's just a duty, you're saying?
Yeah.
But wouldn't the Besdin enforce
that's my duty. How do you differentiate the duty? Anytime you can't change the duties, that's the majority of duties. Like a large majority of them you can't change.
Well, I think I'm thinking that he has no power. Generally a Malva has a power to seize a Mashkon, but he has no power to seize Karba Lila. Right, so it's like that. That's a disability.
It's not seizing; it's just returning. It just dies. It's returning. Right?
Let's say he tried to seize it, by Lila.
And he can aid him. Don't they have power to be exactly
for a cable? I'm thinking about it more. Okay, but this is the basic structure of the Hofeldian framework. Is that you find that helpful? Yeah. So again, so a duty is correlative of a right, right?
Is the duty just like a strong duty?
No, power.
Is strong, right?
So power is second order, meaning it's the ability to change somebody's rights. If the government has powers, an immunity is correlative of a disability. Right, meaning that the government has, when the government has no power to change your rights.
Yeah, okay, but in those cases work.
It's
okay.
So like the Constitution maybe confers like certain immunities.
Or like the tax case.
He's under no duty.
But he's also under no duty.
So that's just a liberty.
Yeah.
Right, but it's more than that because the community, I guess if the community couldn't obligate him to participate, then it would be a disability. So I guess it depends on the sugya and babas, or like what exactly is the point of the halacha there? Is it just that he has no duty to participate, or is the idea that they can't obligate him to? Right? Something like that. Cole, you have further thoughts on this?
I agree with everything you said.
Okay. But you see like the brilliance of the Hofeldian framework. It's just like a very nice, clear way of disambiguating all these terms that have been jumbled together. Yakir, any thoughts on this?
They don't let just anybody teach at Yale. They don't let anybody, just anybody teach at Yale Law School.
That's true, right? He's a gadol. Yakir's sitting outside. Yakir's sitting outside the school over there. Yakir, what do you think of this framework? You find it helpful?
I think it'll be good to see it in practice more.
Yeah, I think we have to see like how helpful this is once we actually get to the sugyas and see if this could help clarify the different positions of the Rishonim. Actually, is that what you're saying, Yakir?
Yeah.
Yeah, me too. I agree 100%. So I think we should be excited to put this into practice throughout the year. That's why I want to get it out early, so that we have this in mind as we go into the sugyas. So now let me just make one other point from this article that Hofeld points out. Well, Hofeld doesn't point this out as explicitly, but it's an important point. Again, that you always have to ask against who holds the right, power, duty, liability, etc., and against whom is it held. That's like the issue that Yoni's pointing out, like in the Bezdin case. There's a lot of confusion. So because Hofeld conceives of these incidents as relational, so you always have to specify who the right holder is and who the duty bearer is. And that's a good way of trying to clean up these relationships, because now you have to know exactly, well, is this a power held against the Bezin, or is it a power held against the Nisa? You can see the Gemara, for example, has this question when it comes to Poel eating from the Balabais. The Gemara wants to know, is it a right held, or let's say a liberty, well, the Gemara wants to know, is it Michel Balabais Uochel, or Michel Shemayim Uochel? So that may take a stand on this question of whether it's really a liberty or a claim. But I think this could be helpful also in other cases as we go through the sugya. So we always want to know who the opposite party in the relationship is. So sometimes you have a power against a court, sometimes you have a power against the state, sometimes you have a right against a group of people, and sometimes it's against just like a individual person. Okay, I've come for that first Hofeld article. I want to make two small points from the second Hofeld article. So Cole, did you end up getting through that article?
No, I didn't have time.
Okay, Yoni, you took a stab at the article, right?
I started it.
So let me tell you what I think are two really important things that come out of the article. So the first is, you should read it on your own time. I mean, over the weekend, just like go through the article and try to get a good sense of what he's doing. So the first point is he has this great distinction between rights in rem and rights in personam. So a right in, so what do you take that to mean? So there's this distinction, let's say a right in the hefta versus a right in the gavra. That's literally what the terms mean. So how do you understand that? Like, what would that mean? A right in the chefta versus a right in the gavra. A right in rem versus a right in persona. Okay, so that's part of it. So he does talk about that. That's incidentally related to this distinction. So he points out that the law has this distinction going back for ages. But he says people are notoriously unclear as to what the distinction actually refers to. This is Hofeld's Godless, right? So he says, some people take a right, they say property is a right in rem. So if I own the table, that means I have a right to the table, or a right in the table. Whereas a right in personam is a right held against somebody else. Okay? Now, what do you think Hofeld's going to say about that distinction? Anybody? Ben, what do you think? What do you think Hofeld's going to say about that distinction?
It's Bobkus.
It's Bobkus. That's exactly right. Why?
I don't know.
Well,
I know.
Yeah, because he's saying that there's no such thing as a right that adheres in the object, right? It's not like I have a right against the table and the table owes a duty to me. At best, what a right in rem would mean is that I have a right held against other people with respect to the table.
They're all rights in persona.
That's right. That's exactly right. Hofeld thinks
to different extents and in different forms.
That's right. When we talk about rights, they're always held against other people, and they may be with respect to certain things. They may not be with respect to certain things, but to the extent that I have rights in certain things, what I really mean is that I hold certain rights against other people with respect to certain objects. Okay? And what he tries to say, which I think is very nice, is that to the extent that you can make sense of a distinction between in rem and in personam rights, what it just means is that a right in rem is usually good against the world. So when I say that I have a right in the table, it just means that everyone in the world, or most people, a universal class, even if there may be an exception or two, they owe a duty to forbear from using my table. whereas a right in personam is limited to like one or two or specified individuals, right? So if I have a contract that Yoni is going to landscape my garden, that's a right in personam, because the right is only good against one individual or maybe a few individuals who work for Yoni. A right in rem is the same. It's really just a relationship between people, just it's universal. So if I have a right to my house, that means that most people in the world have a duty to respect the integrity of my home, et cetera, et cetera. So does that make, do you guys agree with that analysis?
Sure.
Or do you think that in halacha we're going to find, like, no, like, bailus is like some sort of, you know, metaphysical relationship about...
Last we talked a little bit, but I guess the status of animals is questionable in terms of whether it's fully property or it's considered something else. But we did talk a little bit about having, you know, the animal is liable. In a sense, you have a claim on the animals.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that was an interesting... Right, so that view may... lean more into the right in the thing or something. We're treating the animal as a quasi person in that case,
sure, yeah.
Right? Right.
Hey, Tamar, what about the inter bal tashin?
So again, that so ben other the muslim things are going to be a little different, right?
Fine.
Unless you're asking, do I have like a, is the duty...
The motion is a right. What do you say about Tashkent?
Yeah, what about Tashkent?
What do you have like a
positive... You think is that, yeah, you're trying to say the duty is to the thing? I think the duty is klape shmaya.
Yeah, duty is to God regarding...
Regarding the thing.
No, there's no duty. You can't have a duty to, I don't think you can have a duty to a, I don't know, if you make a promise to a tree that you're going to come back and... You know, what about the, I guess the giving tree was like more like a human being, but
the giving tree.
I don't know. You might be able to create. I have to think about this, but there's a certain kind of Kantian, I'd say, that you can create obligations to things like, I don't know.
You can't hear me on it.
Yeah.
No,
I can hear you very well.
You can't hear.
No,
yeah. Cool, we're going to have to fix this. You know what I'm going to try to do? I'm going to try to get something that hooks right into the room so we can... Are you using headphones and a speaker, Cole?
Yeah. I'm not using headphones.
That was good.
That was good.
Yeah, put the mic next to your mouth. Let's try it again.
Oh, I held it close to my mouth. Okay, great. What I was going to say is there's a certain kind of Kantian who might think that you can... I mean, first I thought about the giving tree, and then I realized, of course, the giving tree is a rational being. But then I thought, like, there's a certain kind of Kantian who might think that a promise, that keeping a promise is a first person, not an interpersonal obligation. That it's an interpersonal obligation, but there's no need for it to be accepted. You could just declare, right, if I just say to you, Itamar, you know, I promise I'll be at your house tomorrow. Well, I would say that if I fail to be at your house tomorrow, then that's a problem. But just because I've broken my word,
not because of what you owe me.
Right. Not necessarily because of what I owe you is completely dependent on what I've done. And not at all dependent on anything you've done, which suggests that your being a rational animal doesn't enter into the question.
I think the standard, the Hofeldian view, would be that when you make a promise to me, so I have certain, that creates certain rights that I hold against you.
No, it does do that. The question is whether a promise is conceivable
without the relational...
Even a deadan is like a...
You could do this thought experiment. Like, if you make a promise to yourself, are you duty-bound to uphold it? Right?
I think you are, unless you release yourself from it.
I'm not sure. But this is the first. This is the first.
Yeah, I know.
Let's reserve judgment for whether we'll find such a thing as like a real right in rem in any of these cases. I think Hofeld's probably right that it makes sense to conceive of these as relations between people with respect to things. Is that consistent? I think that's the best way to think about it for now, unless we encounter something to the contrary. The second point that's really interesting in that second
one. I generally agree.
Yeah. And I think it's going to generally be true for the relationships that we'll study. So here's the last point of our Hakdama. So on page 752 in the second article, Hofeld points out that it's important not to confuse the distinction between the primary right and the secondary right. A secondary right that emerges from the primary right. So, what does he mean? Ben?
What's the basis for the distinction, or what's the primary and secondary?
What's the primary and secondary right?
The primary is the privilege of claim, secondary is power and immunity.
No. No. So here, Hofeld's using all these. You could have your primary powers, and let's just talk about primary rights, primary claim rights for now.
Okay.
Does anybody know what the distinction is? 752. So Hofeld.
I haven't read the article, but I assume that the distinction is between rights that you have, like against the person violating you, and then the rights that you have to seek recourse.
Exactly right. That's exactly what he means. And this is a crucial point. You knocked it out of the park. What's that? So I have a right that you not trespass on my property, or a right that you not harm me. If you go ahead and violate that right, so then that creates a secondary. You violate the primary right. That creates a secondary right of a right to compensation. Hofeld's saying, you got to be careful. Your right to compensation is distinct from your right not to be harmed. You see that? What are your intuitions on this?
The thing there is always a consequence, so to speak.
What?
It's always like a consequence of violating the first right.
It's a derivative. That's right. It's a derivative of the primary. The secondary right is a derivative of the primary right. And so my right to compensation, and he has this great discussion here, if you read it, it seems like common law used to be like halacha, where if a ganav steals, he acquires a kinyan, and it's his. And so Hofeld points out that when somebody takes your property, like they steal it, so they violate your primary right, that gives rise to a secondary duty of restitution to give it back. But the duty of restitution is distinct from the original duty not to take it. So what happens...
I think Shano Nikar is a good example.
I mean, that's clear where the duty of... there's no duty of compensation.
Right, Nikar, it's a kanaf, but it's durable.
Right. So, I mean, people often confuse this. So take, for example, like discussions of reparations, like discussions that you have now, like here. So people who argue for reparations say things like, so people coerced blacks into slavery. That was a violation of their property rights in themselves or something. So they stole basically from them. They stole their autonomy. And that was never paid back, right? I mean, they were never compensated for those years where they're essentially deprived of their own property rights. And they were never paid back. And now that duty to compensate has like collected interest over the years, right? I mean, even if it's 500 years later, they still are entitled to get back their labor that was taken from them, right? That's one view. Does that make sense? The counter-argument goes something like this, and it says their rights were violated. The people who violated those rights have a duty to compensate them, but that duty falls off over time. meaning who are the people who have that duty to compensate them? Well, it's presumably people who violated the primary rights or something. It's not like a property right where you could say that house was mine 300 years ago and now it's still my house 300 years later. That would be if the secondary right was the same thing as the primary right. Right? So it's like, it's my right to my house. I never lost that right to my house, and so I get it back 300 years later. Contrast that with the view which distinguishes the secondary right from the primary right and says, somebody stole your house, so the primary right is, let's say, it's gone, it's past history. They have a secondary duty to compensate you, but that has nothing to do with your present ownership over the house, right? Your present ownership of the house is long gone. They have a duty of restitution, but if they don't make restitution, then, you know, you may lose everything.
Well, just sort of the opposite, meaning it is something in reverse about the people whose original rights were violated. Right? In general, it's one thing, the compensation, and there's no distinction between primary and secondary. Then the right of compensation stems from those original people. But if you divide them into two different things, even if the original people who were violated are no longer around also, or they have also passed away, then that secondary right still remains. The secondary right is not tied to the
right.
original violation. Of
but right. the secondary right, though, in here is usually... Secondary duty vests in the wrongdoers, right?
Does it? You have a duty to... Right, I guess you're saying, like, those specific people.
So I'm giving the example of the house, right? So if the house, it's my house, and, like, I never lost title to the house, so it's my house 300 years later. That would be, like, if we're still dealing with the primary right. But once the primary right is gone, then you no longer have a claim to the house, you just have a claim to some sort of compensation for it. And then it's a secondary, and it's an open question still whether that compensation survives, like the death of the wrongdoer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Right? But that's the idea that Hofeld's getting at here. You just have to distinguish between the primary right and the secondary right. Right?
Sure.
So one area where this might be helpful, so think of it in terms of the breach of contract stuff that we'll see in the first sugya. So if I contract my services to you and I say that I'm going to build you a home, let's say, and then I breach the agreement... I breached the primary right. I breached my primary duty. So what obligation does that give rise to? So you might say, well, that just gives rise to a secondary obligation of compensation, right, which is distinct from the primary duty, which was to build a house. Or you might say, no, like the primary duty still survives, and we should compel the worker with specific performance, where he still has a duty, he still has to go ahead and build the house. You see that? So in one case, we view the remedy as still related to the primary duty, the duty to build a home. In the other case, we're saying, no, that duty has been breached and it's long gone. Now we just have to figure out the secondary duty that arises from breaching the primary one, so some sort of like duty to compensate. You see that? You see how that distinction can turn on the primary versus the secondary, right? Yes, or
yeah.
Yoni?
Yeah.
But?
So I think the other case is the case where if you refuse not to say performance, but you refuse to work, so the Gemara says you have either you can trick him into working.
Yeah,
in
Devarave.
Right, you can kind of lie to him. Or,
but we never compel him, right? It seems
right.
Like
or
we... We'll see that. Some opponent think you can compel.
Or you grab, like, a macho.
Right.
Like, those things, what are those little secondary rights, I guess?
Yeah, sounds like it. Right? It sounds like the mashkon is definitely secondary. Right? A secondary right to compensation.
I have a right to compensation.
The first thing of matan might be, like, no, you really have a right to have the labor completed. Right? And you're just using a deceptive technique to get him to complete the labor.
And the Mashkin can also be the same way? It's like a way of completing the work?
But it's not. It's compensation for losses.
Well, completing the
Oh, because you're going to hire other workers with the value of the Mashkin. Right. I should say, sure, to follow Ben's terminology. Yeah, we have to think about that. That's good. So that's all I have to say about... I mean, that's it for the Hakdama. That's it for this, like, cumbersome...
I got to sign off.
Yeah, we're going to...
I have to sign off.
Okay. That's all I have to say for the Hakdama. And then, so our next couple will pick up with the actual Kinyan Schiras Polim, and I want you to map out the first Sigya, about what the different components of the Sigya are and what areas we have to lay out for us to look into. Yakir, you have any comments before we sign off?
Nope.
Okay. So what I'm excited to do is to try to bring this Hofeldian framework and the rights framework and the duties framework to bear on these dinim. I mean, all these dinim are going to be about the correlative rights and duties. And so I want to try to just be as precise as possible when we go through them and mapping out what the dinim are and what the relationships of Schiras Polim amount to. Sounds good? Yakir, no further thoughts?
Great.
Okay. Ben? Comments? Yoni? All right. Goodish. Good.
Are we talking about
sentimental sources?
What's that?
Sentimental sources.
Yeah.